What is it that gives us the power to forgive? What is it that makes us want or even need forgiveness? What is it that makes the whole concept of forgiveness a little difficult for us sometimes? These hard questions are what I want to explore this morning. And as I do, I am hoping that our time together might also bring some understanding to the religious nature of forgiveness. And I'm hoping that perhaps I can help to clarify what stance Unitarian Universalism takes in forgiveness. And maybe contain in my sermon somewhere just a little understanding about this thing that some of us call God. I want you to know that I don't often set my sights this high for a single sermon. But I do so today because I know that the mark of my success will not be measured by how well I am able to reveal the truth about religion or uncover the purpose of being Unitarian Universalist or even explaining God. I know that the mark of my success today will be measured at the end when I fail to adequately explain any of this, in whether what I have said has helped you to forgive me, and to know how important forgiveness is to me and to all of us. I want to start with a story that goes way back for me, partly because I believe it illustrates the role of forgiveness in our lives in a very primal, basic way, but mostly because it reveals that the human struggle for forgiveness can be very funny and tender and hard. It starts one morning when I was about 5 years old. My brother and sister and I were with my mom on our weekly ritual of grocery shopping. In our family, there was great incentive for going on the weekly grocery run. Our family lived by the rule that every child got to choose their own box of cereal. And we knew that staying at home meant for settling for the de facto choice of the cheapest or the healthiest brand, and we had no intention of being cheap or healthy. There are many alluring reasons for choosing a box of cereal, but at the tender age of 5, there is nothing more compelling than the free inside item. This morning, I want to tell you about choosing honeycombs. And let me be clear, I don't like honeycombs. Honeycombs, for those of you who have not had it, is like sugar-coated perforated particle board. The pieces are so large that they will choke you to death if you do not chew them well. And they are second only to grape nuts in hardness, which means that if you don't let them soak in the milk for at least 20 minutes, they will take off the first 3 layers of the roof of your mouth before you can swallow them. I chose honeycombs for the free inside item because on the back of that box, on specially coated cardboard, they lathed a record. It was the hit single, Sugar Sugar by the Archies. I wanted that record. Getting my mom to buy the cereal was easy. Eating it was a whole different thing. And because I was determined to have that record right away, I attempted to consume the entire box in one sitting. Mistake number one. Any box that can fit a record on the back of it, even a single, is needless to say, a rather large box with lots of cereal. I ate as fast as I could, finishing one bowl and starting another. Mistake number two, I didn't let the cereal soak long enough. Somewhere during the third bowl of cereal, I discovered that my mouth was bleeding. Still, determined to get the record, I tried to cut the record out from the back of the box without compromising the integrity of the cereal liner. But kindergarten scissors and impatient five-year-old fingers are not the stuff that stealth is made from. Mistake number three, the cereal liner was compromised. A trail of honeycombs led to where I shoved the gutted and leaking box into the back of the cupboard. And it was while I was attempting to flatten out a warped piece of cardboard onto our vintage 1953 console stereo that I heard the ominous roar of the gods who had watched over that land, letting me know that a great unrest was about to descend. Here is where I ask you to use your imagination. Think for a few minutes. Imagine the scream that travels through the home where you live. Imagine the look on a five-year-old's face, sensing that they are not loved. Imagine the thoughts and the feelings that press against him. Or imagine something that you have done sometime in your life that might have put you in such a place. Can you feel the panic, the dread that others may have come across your transgression, the fear of being judged? But deeper than that, for many of us, the creeping feeling of estrangement, of suddenly discovering that you are living on the outside of a circle that you had worked your whole life to live inside of, and knowing in the depth of your soul that you know not how to get back in without the uncomfortable judgment. Well, suddenly, this sermon may sound an awful lot like guilt to some of us, or shame. And how many people don't respond very well to guilt or shame? How many people decided to cancel all reservations with religions that were organizing guilt trips? I would be with you on that. Too often, I think guilt and shame have been used to manipulate people and have done great harm. Religion in general has been a major player in the guilt and shame industry, hurting well-intentioned people. But I also believe that there are some elements found within guilt and shame that can be important, even healthy, and constantly learning to override or ignore those elements can do us great harm. Those of us who grew up in the Judeo-Christian tradition might remember a creation story that speaks of God making the world, and after God makes the world, declaring everything in it, pronouncing it good. Take note, God did not pronounce it amazing. God did not say it was perfect. God said it was good. It is goodness that we are all made from. It is goodness that we all strive for, not perfection, but it is the idea of judgment that presses so many of our buttons. From the time that my mom discovered the box of honeycombs to the time that the entire family was gathered in the living room was only a matter of minutes. There were only five of us in our family, but it felt like we were in a circle in the courtroom of 12 angry men. My mother, my father, my brother, my sister, and me in one circle. My mother began the conversation. "We found a box of honeycombs in the cupboard with a hole cut out of it." A laughing smirk came spasmodically from my brother. "And we just wanted to know if anyone here might know anything about this." My eyes felt like they were tethered to an anchor on the floor, but I could feel the stares of my family on me with pinpoint accuracy. Silence. "No one knows anything?" Silence. "We just want to know the truth." Silence. "Nothing else, just the truth." Silence. And without a doubt, it was the most painful silence I have ever known in my entire life. There is a pain that I became familiar with that day. It is a pain that I believe everybody knows, each in their own unique way. It is a pain that is part of the human condition, the part of us that always aspires toward trust and connection with our partners, with our parents, with our community, with life itself, and with ourselves. And when something happens to break that trust or to block that connection, the pain can leave us feeling isolated and alone, separate from everything that matters to us. At its best, I believe that religion is designed to help us transcend that feeling of separateness, either through love or understanding, to cultivate an awareness that we are all one. But I also know that how religion has been carried out associates it with judgment that has hurt people. And I am sad for all that has been lost in our inability as human beings to offer religion as it could be, a healing and uniting thing. I am not sure which was more painful, being unable to say anything in that circle or being able to look anyone in the face. But I kid you not, it was 3 hours that I sat in that circle with my family without being able to share my transgression. After the first hour, my siblings lost their sense of humor and they began to show open hostility and resentment about the fact that they too, the innocents, were stuck indoors with me, the obviously guilty party, on a great sunny day. Even my father was getting weary after about 2 hours and began openly questioning how long we were going to continue this charade. This week, we enter into the highest of holy days of the Jewish calendar. The days between Rosh Hashanah, which was last Sunday, and Yom Kippur, which starts on Tuesday, are called the Days of Awe, or the Days of Atonement. And they are a call to the people of a covenant, to anyone among them who feels that they might have done something to cause separation. It calls them to seek atonement, or at-one-ment. It is a time of reflection. And for the Jewish people, they look at it as a time to recast the covenant to include anyone who has fallen away, who in the depths of their heart wants back in, who is willing to choose honesty and humility over isolation. For the Jewish people and for many other people, it is a difficult tender, and beautiful time. Religious historians distinguish Judaism as a tiny sect which emerged from a vast sea of pagans, those who understood and worshipped many gods working to govern the cosmos. But something that I've always been fascinated with was that the early Jews, those who began the concept of monotheism, did not denounce polytheism, the idea that many gods operated. They simply believed that one God, Yahweh, brought all gods together into one conversation with the human people. A conversation based on a covenant extended between Abraham and Yahweh. And this covenant basically says this: I will be yours and you will be mine. And together we will make promises. And together we will find our way to a promised place. But the problem, as Jewish theologian Martin Buber once said, that human beings are a promise-making, promise-breaking, promise-remaking people. We were not made perfect. We constantly fall short of even our most basic promises, and we are constantly called back to the task of reuniting with our best selves. That is what Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is for. To help us find our way back together. Colleague Barry Whittemore often describes Unitarian Universalism as a 2,000-year-old Jewish reform movement. The difference is, he says, that Unitarian Universalists never believed that the Reformation was over. But his point is that at the heart of who Unitarian Universalists are as people, more than creeds, more than the idea of one God versus many gods, is the understanding of covenant, of what holds us together. The notion that I will be yours and you will be mine, and together we will make promises. And because we are imperfect, we will break those promises sometimes. But ultimately, because we are more about love than about judgment, we will find our way back together again. We are not interested in punishing anyone, my mom said several times as time marched on and we sat tensely in that circle. We just want to know the truth. We just want to become a whole family again. But I struggled to believe her. I was stuck on the whole notion of judgment, of being wrong, of being seen as bad. And though I didn't know it, I was introduced at that moment to everything I didn't like about God. It was clear to me that that day, as it has been since, that I would never be able to abide by a God who judges. A God who sits at a big desk and looks over his glasses, over his ledger, down through the clouds to keep tabs on everything that I did and write it all down in a big book. That is a popular notion today, the God of judgment. It is one of the reasons why I believe that religion has failed in its purpose of uniting people. But there are three things that help me get past that destructive notion of religion and God. The first is a quote from Sufi poet Rumi, where he says, "There is a field that exists somewhere beyond right or wrong, beyond good or bad. I will meet you there." The second was meeting and talking to all kinds of people about religion and God who also struggled to see God as something more than judge, who learned to see God as an activist who works for justice, or as a nurse who seeks to heal the sick, or as a mourner in a cemetery who grieves losses, or as a writer, maybe even a humorist, who just watches and writes down our funny, quirky little habits, or my favorite, God who is like a porter who accepts our baggage and helps us find our place on the train. And my faith has also been renewed by people who see beyond God altogether, who just see others in need, and then form a place that they welcome people back into, where people can feel a little less separated, a little less lost, a little more found. And the third thing that helped me happened when I was 5. It was 3 hours that we waited together in that living room. And yes, there was some complaining and some exasperation, but I believe now that those people in that living room would have waited for me forever if that's what it took for me to find my way back into that family. Holding a space until I was able to find atonement. But luckily, it did not last forever. At the end of the 3rd hour, we held a secret ballot. Sometimes it takes creative measures like that. And on a small piece of paper I wrote in orange crayon, I did it. I lied. I'm sorry. And without another word, much to my siblings' relief, that circle of judgment ended. But on that day, a circle of love and understanding was cast that will never be broken. And it is a circle which I have made a promise to extend as wide and as far as I am able to imagine. That is covenant. It is a place without judgment, of people willing to hold a circle until those who have felt cast out can find their way back in. It is what I believe religion can be, and it is what I believe this religion tries to be, and it is what this religion sometimes fails to be, and it's what this religion is constantly being called back to. If you thought that living with a God who judges is hard, try living with a God who calls you into a circle, not for 3 hours, but for a lifetime, and asks you not to judge. That is hard. And that is the promise of this community: to do the hard work, to love people through the trials, the places where we fall short, in the hopes that one day all people's names will be written into the book of life. May we for another week strive to love one another well, to the glory of life.